we have a new show at Turpentine that's been in the works for a long time, Company Breakdowns. We dive into S1s and Series B and beyond companies, interviewing founders and investors to break down the companies. First episode is on Rubrik, which IPO'd this week. Upcoming episodes cover Reddit, Databricks, and more. Subscribe at the link in the description or search for Company Breakdowns on YouTube or in the podcast platform of your choice.
Welcome to Econ 102, where economist Noah Smith and I make sense of what's happening in the news, technology, business, and beyond through the lens of economics. Let's jump right in.
So last week was a great listener mailbag week. We got a number of great questions. As always, email us and we will ask them. And we'll get into some of the questions and then we'll get into one of your pieces that actually segue quite nicely. So first, let's start with our listener. Oh man, this is a fun one. Nubby Schober, N-U-B-B-Y-S-H-O-B-E-R.
What's up, Nubby?
Nubby asks, can you please demystify the workings of the Fed? For example, please explain the non-political, i.e. purely economical pros and cons of Federal Reserve policy as it pertains to the setting of rates. How much is too high and why? How little is too low and why? Maybe you can compare and contrast a Chicago versus Keynesian approach to Powell's reasoning.
Well, you know, so the traditional view is that basically if the Fed raises interest rates, inflation will go down and the economy will get hurt. And if the Fed lowers interest rates, the economy will get helped, but inflation will go up. And this is sort of your standard trade-off that people thought was you know, how the Fed worked. And people, in fact, still think this by and large. It's just, you know, higher interest rates hurts the economy, but restrains inflation. Lower interest rates helps the economy, but lets inflation rip. So that this is the conventional wisdom, and everything else should sort of proceed from that conventional wisdom. You know, you should start off thinking about this. Now, you know, in the 1970s, it seemed as if we were, you know, cutting interest rates, but the economy wasn't getting helped. We were still getting stagflation, and inflation was still really high, but we weren't managing to juice the economy like that. And so people came out with this theory that, okay, so what happens is that lower interest rates only juice the economy when they're sort of unexpected, and you know the effect of monetary policy will wear off after a little while. You'll juice the economy a little while, but then it'll wear off. People will get used to the sort of lower interest rates, higher inflation. Then inflation will go even higher, and you'll have to cut interest rates like even more just to keep it going. And then eventually you just get hyperinflation and everything just explodes. So that idea became popular in the 70s when we saw, you know, high inflation. Since then, it's kind of gone out of style. People have gone more back toward the original thinking of, okay, well, you can sort of adjust it up and down. The problem is that there's what they call long and variable lag. So it's not clear, you know, when you raise interest rates today and then tomorrow, you know, inflation goes down, but then the economy doesn't get hurt, or maybe the economy gets hurt 2 years later, something like that. So it's very difficult to sort of see these correlations in the data and to know, you know, to have this fine control. All the economic models imagine this very fine level of control, like the interest rate is this dial, right? That you dial, right? You're like, okay, hotter economy, colder economy. But in real life, you know, you turn it this way and like you get, you know, one effect today and then another effect in 2 years. And so, or maybe not at all, because conditions are sort of different in the economy. So it's this very inexact science. So nobody really knows. And then other people want to bring in stuff like financial considerations, like, oh, if you keep interest rates too low, you'll cause financial bubbles. Well, we don't actually know that's true. We don't have any evidence that that is true, but it's a thing that might be true. You know, there certainly was a crash after in like tech stocks in 2022 after interest rates started going up. And so people think, okay, well, so maybe just the reciprocals do. So you lower interest rates and tech, you know, stocks go up. And, you know, Bitcoin certainly appears to obey this law. Like Bitcoin, you know, interest rates going down appears to juice Bitcoin, and interest rates going up appears to hurt Bitcoin. So it's not really clear what's you know, actually going on there. So I'd say that monetary policy is a thing we don't really understand. We have some principles, and we try to set monetary policy based on those principles without really understanding it.
He has a follow-up question, which is, how much of inflationary pressure is still due to oligopoly-level multinationals like Unilever raising their prices above their operating costs? A few years ago, I read some EU economists argued that 50% of inflationary pressure in the EU at the time was due to price gouging from companies like Unilever. that wanted to leverage their enormous market presence to boost profits, but also supercharge inflation as a result. Don't know if it's even possible to quantify that variable, but your understanding would be appreciated.
Right. So this is the question of what they call greedflation, right? And no one has really come up with a convincing model of how this works. Some people, you know, Isabella Weber from Germany has come up with a model of, you know, greedflation that's a little bit hand-wavy, you know, relying on the idea that inflation is sort of this coordinating signal that tells all these companies to raise their price at the same time. And before that, they didn't know they could. And blah, blah, blah. But it hasn't really been formalized in game theory, and it's not clear whether formalizing would help. One important piece of information is that there seems to be, in the recent inflation, there was no correlation at all between rising prices and rising markups. So a markup is sort of similar to like operating profit. It's related. It's you know, basically with the price you charge over marginal cost, right? So if your store and it costs you like $10 to get something and then you sell it for $20, that's 100% markup. So what we saw was a lack of correlation between increases in markups and increases in prices. Okay, that seems to be a blow against the greedflation idea, because if you're gouging, you should be able to get like this extra markup, right? You should be able to get this, like, you know, you were making a 10% profit and now suddenly, you know, you're able to gouge and now you make a 50% profit or something like that, right? We didn't see that at all. We saw just complete randomness in terms of that correlation. But it's also possible that the companies with large existing markups simply kept their large existing markups by raising the price there. So it could be that, you know, companies with a 100% profit margin kept their 100% profit margin, you know, even in this time, it didn't compress at all, and it should have compressed. And that's the monopoly power problem. So that is a thing that could have happened. It's very difficult to test if that did happen, because we don't know. But you know, all of these things we're observing are very consistent with a demand shock. They're very consistent with just, you know, people wanted more stuff, so they bought more stuff. So companies were able to raise the price. And there hasn't, you know, people want more stuff and you can charge them more for it because they want more stuff is like, that's, you know, and the reason they'd want more stuff is because they had a bunch of cash they got during the pandemic, or their savings rate, they lowered their savings rate, or their, you know, et cetera, or there were low interest rates, so they wanted to spend instead of save, or there was fiscal stimulus, so they spent that cash. All these reasons why there could be demand, why people could be demanding more stuff. But the idea that when, you know, when you're a store and people come to you and say, here, I will, you know, I'm willing to pay a lot, you know, then you're like, okay, well, I'm going to charge you more. I mean, that's very natural, sort of, you know, it doesn't require, obviously greed is involved because like every company just wants to make money and greed is ubiquitous. Greed is sort of the natural state of capitalism and well, not even just capitalism, but just human nature. It's like, I want more money so I can buy more K-pop songs or whatever, you know, I want. So I can buy a better fursuit for my kids, because we're a furry family. And we go to the mall as furries dressed, you know, all together. So really, you know, that's just capitalism. And so it's not yet clear that greedflation is anything different than just a standard demand shock.
Simon Griffiths asks, why do central banks need to decide interest rates? Couldn't this be market-based? Why can't the interest rate be decided by a simple formula which responds directly to inflation expectations over the next 5 years? For example, interest rates equals 3x minus 6, where x is the expected annual inflation rate over the next 5 years.
We absolutely could. But so the question is, why can't we do that? Well, we absolutely could do that. There's nothing stopping us from replacing the central bank with just a bot that changes interest rates. There's a couple issues with that, because so if the rule is miscalibrated, you could get the entire economy to explode. So it's pretty easy to show how if you get the wrong rule, it could be like, okay, well, you know, we need to lower interest rates, right? Because the economy is too slow. And then you raise inflation a whole lot, and then people, you know, the normal relationship reverses for a little while, and then you get people saying like, oh my God, like, you know, the inflation's out of control. I'm going to save my money and not spend, and I'm not going to go to work, and I'm going to move to Argentina where the, you know, there's low inflation now because of Milei. And so then, I don't know, but the point is that the economy could take a hit and we could go into stagflation. And then the bot, you know, Fed bot you know, which is just a one line of Python script. FedBot says, okay, well, we guess what? You know, the economy is doing really bad, so we need to lower inflation even more. And so they lower interest rates even more. And so they lower interest rates even more, and then inflation just explodes. And so you can say, okay, well, okay, that was a bad rule, Noah. We need a bet. Obviously, we need a rule that doesn't make the economy explode. Well, okay, find me one, right? So, you know, even with, you know, people like NGDP targeting, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, even with NGDP targeting, it's pretty easy to show that this mechanical rule can lead to like wild swings in the economy, up and down, up and down, up and down, you know, because right. Also, it's not clear exactly which things should go into the like inflation expectations, right? So, it's notable that inflation expectations, so you could have the five-year break-even rate or the five-year forward rate, which is the expectation not for the next 5 years, but for the 5 years after that. So which of those things do you put in there? You know, in the most recent inflation, five-year break-evens went up like a little bit, and five-year forwards didn't go up at all, really. All barely went up at all. People all seemed to expect that the Fed would get inflation, you know, under control within 5 to 10 years. And so... then, you know, so then you, you're like, okay, well, we'll use the five-year break even. Okay, well, fine. Well, inflation rose a lot more than the five-year break even. Five-year break even was like, boop, and the inflation was like, boop, and it was like, it was pretty, you know, unexpected. So the question is, do we do anything about that? Or do we just say, okay, you know what? We're not going to raise interest rates at all. So if we had raised interest rates only in response to inflation expectations, we wouldn't have done a damn thing. We would have like raised interest rates like a tiny little quarter of a point or something like that in response to the tiny increase in inflation expectations that we had. You know, without, we wouldn't have done what we did. And what we did seems to have been very successful. So these rules are just extremely rigid and simple. And we don't actually know, like, we don't actually know what the rule should be. For any rules, like the Taylor rule or other, you know, a Taylor type rule, a forward-looking Taylor type rule, which is the thing this person is asking about, you can do a whole bunch of theory to show cases in which those rules fail catastrophically. So it's like, okay, well, what rule do we construct? What's the perfect rule? Well, nobody knows. And so that's why we use discretion instead.
Yeah. So I want to briefly follow up with that, right, talking about NGDP targeting for a second, because I've talked to Scott Sumner a couple of times, sort of this market monetarism crew, right? What do they basically say? They're basically saying something like, hey, we should focus on nominal GDP and have a sort of specific like target level, whether it's like 4% or whatever that number is,
right,
that businesses can sort of
5%, I think,
clarity. Yeah, can focus on that, can have clarity, and they think it's better metric to focus on than inflation or interest rates or real GDP, because the economy is measured and it, you know, is more reacts to NGDP or it's more legible because you know it's real dollars. I guess that's a pretty simplistic or maybe incorrect articulation. Why don't you articulate what is the steel man for NGDP targeting, and then maybe further why you don't agree with it?
Well, so NGDP targeting is simply a fancy version of the normal, you know, flexible inflation targeting that we use. It's basically saying that, you know, NGDP is essentially real GDP growth plus inflation. So it's saying that if inflation is, if you know, real GDP growth gets too low, then NGDP goes down. So you boost the economy by cutting interest rates. And if inflation gets too high, NGDP growth is too high. So you restrain the economy by raising interest rates. And so it's basically just, you know, a version of what we have right now. It's not actually that different. It's simply, it is more legible and more understandable. There's some problems with it. One is that, So there's a couple ways to get to 5% NGDP growth. Okay. So you can get, you could have 0% growth and 5% inflation, which I think most people would not like. That is, stagflation is consistent with 5% NGDP growth. And in there, you know, they said, okay, stagflation, there's nothing we can do about it. Well, that's a very like theory heavy choice, right? You have to really strongly believe in the theory that you can't do anything about stagflation. If there's something else in the theory, for example, suppose the 5% inflation is causing companies to not hire and invest because they're, you know, they're worried about variable and they're worried about this and that. And, you know, suppose the 5% inflation is causing companies not to invest, and that's not in your theory, right? And then you're just, okay, the central bank says, okay, guess what? We hit 5% NGDP. We have no growth and 5% inflation. you're getting 5% poorer every year, and this is fine. And GDP targeting says that if you get 5% poorer every year, that is fine. There's nothing monetary policy can or should do about that. Now, that might be right. It might be that we only arrive in a situation where you get 5% poorer every year because of external shocks that monetary policy cannot do a goddamn thing about. Maybe, but that's a theory. And people would get mad at that theory very, very quickly. Right. So note that you could also get 5% in GDP with 0% inflation and 5% growth, which everyone would love.
Yeah.
Except for people who are in debt, because they would like inflation to erode their debt. And except for companies that need to cut wages sometimes, because, you know, then they would have to cut nominal wages instead of real. But most people would love 5% real GDP growth. And so the point is that there's no economic theory that says NGDP is inherently good, because NGDP is a mixture. It's a mutt. It's a melange of different three M words there, of different things that we care about. And so there's, you know, imagine 0% growth with 5% inflation. You get 5% poorer steadily every year, and that's the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Great. That sucks. I hate it. Thanks. I hate it. And then so like, you know, and then, but imagine 0% inflation, 5% growth. You get 5% richer and you know exactly what prices are going to be tomorrow. Thanks. I love it. And so, you know, the idea that these two things should be viewed as exactly equally as desirable from a policy standpoint doesn't make sense.
I totally get that. I think the critique that the monetarists have of measuring inflation is that it treats supply shocks and demand shocks as if they're the same thing, when in reality you'd want different responses for each. Because with a supply shock, inflation goes up and output goes down.
Sure.
And a demand shock, inflation goes up, but output also can go up.
And no, this is a theory. Like the you know, supply and demand theory is very simple. This that theory says that if you have 5% inflation, 0% growth, it's entirely because of supply shocks, right? And there's nothing monetary policy can do about supply. Nothing. Monetary policy does not affect supply, because guess what? The economy works with these two little fucking lines that I drew on the graph, and that's the economy. That's the whole macroeconomy, is a supply and demand graph. And if you have low growth and high inflation, it is because of the supply curve. Ontologically, that is the only thing. There's two gods in the sky doing their little dance named supply and demand, and that is the entire totality of macroeconomics.
That's what I learned.
Anyway, do you believe that? I don't. I think that the supply and demand model is a good general heuristic. It's a good explanatory device. It's often useful. But then, you know, in terms of absolutely believing that this theory is the only thing going on, and that monetary policy doesn't affect supply at all, I am not willing to commit to that. I think it is hubris to think we understand that much about the macroeconomy. It is hubris to think that if we have 5% inflation and 0% growth and everyone's getting, that monetary policy couldn't do anything about that.
Yeah. This is a good overview of this point.
Hey, everybody. Eric here with a word from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Warp. If you're a founder with employees in multiple states, you know managing state tax compliance is complicated. Warp not only automates state tax compliance, but also offers a user-friendly experience tailored to the needs of startups with a robust in-house team of experts. Warp ensures your startup remains compliant across all 50 states, giving you the peace of mind you need to focus on scaling your business. They also make it easy for startups to provide health benefits for employees, hire international contractors, and even claim R&D tax credits. Hundreds of startups trust Warp to handle their payroll and compliance needs. You can go from zero to payroll live in just 2 days. Don't let payroll and compliance hold your startup back. Visit joinwarp.com/peel or tap the link in the description. Get started and receive a $1,000 gift card when you run your very first payroll. That's joinwarp.com/peel. If you don't already subscribe to Turpentine's industry-leading newsletters, like our new daily AI newsletter, Emergent Behavior, or Media Empires, you should. But that's not what I'm here to tell you about. The platform we use to power these newsletters is called Beehive, and it's excellent. First of all, it was started by the same early team who helped build Morning Brew into a $75 million newsletter business. And they built Beehive to offer that same powerful functionality to anyone sending emails. From essayists to business owners, the platform is beautiful, their text editor is intuitive, and they help you scale your audience with custom growth features. Beehive has powerful tools to help you monetize your content. You can easily launch paid subscriptions or pursue an advertising model. The Beehive platform will even connect you to premium brands to sponsor your newsletter. Not only do we use them, but thousands of the top newsletters in the world also use them, like Milk Road, Blockworks, the Lindy Newsletter, and so many more. Beehive's founder hooked up Moment of Zen listeners with a sweet deal. Get 20% off for 3 months with code MOZ. Visit beehive.com, that's BEEHIIV.com, to get started.
Let's move on to additional questions. This is by Ed Smilde, S-M-I-L-D-E. It might be Smilled, but I like Smilde.
Smilde.
Yes. Hey, Ed. Ed asks, in the last few years, housing prices have gone up a lot more in Canada than in the U.S. Why is this? Is it due to higher rates of immigration?
Maybe. I think Chinese capital flight's a big story here. A lot of people, you know, perceive China's, you know, government as unpredictable, unstable economy. A lot of rich people want to get a lot of their money outside of China. So, you know, what do? You buy real estate because nobody's walking around auditing. First of all, real estate, China is like very much like the United States in that they're obsessed with real estate. If you want to, like, this is all my theory that China and America actually have the same culture, just don't realize it. And part of that culture is thinking that your house is going to make you rich. You just invest in real estate, it'll go up and, you know, price go up. And then, like, that's how I get rich. That's my nest egg. And so that's basically what happens in China. And then, you know, so they just had an equivalent of 2008 in China with you know, housing sort of bubble collapse. But and it looks somewhat similar to what we saw, not entirely the same, but somewhat similar. So all these people are trying to get their money out. What do they know how to invest in? They know how to invest in real estate. Also, it's easy to see. If a whole bunch of Chinese investors start buying stocks, it might be easier to see because you can sort of like see which brokers, blah, blah, blah. But real estate is like a lot more secret. You know, it's like, who owns that house? Well, it's Chinese billionaire, or is it? Like, you know, so I think that there's been some capital flight from China, and Canada is a much preferred destination to America. Both because, I don't know. I mean, like, there's many reasons I could speculate on that, but it's just a fact that Canada has gotten hit with Chinese capital flight more than America. Canada has a problem with not building housing at all. America has a problem not building housing, but in America, we have all this cheap housing in the suburbs and cheap housing in sort of declining towns. Like you can go to like the suburbs of Philadelphia and you can get a house, man. I'll give you a house. You can go to Mobile, Alabama. You can get a house cheap, right? Or even in some nice places, you can go to Corvallis, Oregon. You can get a house cheap. You can no longer get a cheap house in Bozeman, Montana. That one's kind of done. But anyway, but in Canada, you know, there's more restrictive land use stuff, even on suburban, you know, sprawl. So it's like, instead of, you know, some places restrict sprawl and then build up. Canada restricts sprawl and then doesn't really build up. So Canada's housing restrictions, it's really, we see a lot of housing restrictions in the Anglosphere. We see countries that are descended from England in some way have worse housing restrictions. America has slightly not as bad housing restrictions because we fought the British and rebelled. Canada, you know, being wimps, you know, just waited for Britain to like give them their independence, like Australia. And so they've got a worse housing situation. So basically Canada needs to build more housing. And then also, you know, maybe they can build like some new ghost cities in the Saskatchewan or whatever to accommodate the Chinese capital flight. And Chinese investors will be very at home investing in empty skyscrapers. Who knows?
Related question. This one's from Jacob. How should we think about gentrification? When enacting YIMBY policies, should we take steps to mitigate the effect of rising property values driving out residents of historically low-income neighborhoods? Or is that not the right way to think about it?
Well, first of all, it's not the right way to think about it because you know, evidence shows that when you build a fancy new luxury building in a neighborhood, then rents decline even in that neighborhood, but they decline like even more throughout the city. So, gentrification is not a great way to think about it, especially because a lot of the places that you might think of as being gentrified are actually places that are sort of declining. Places that you're worried about being gentrified, like, oh no, don't move to Detroit. Well, okay, really? Like Detroit is a, you know, it's a Mad Max, you know, wasteland with like ivy growing over the ruin. Detroit's like a ruin. If people really want to build something there and move there, are you really going to stop them because gentrification? No, be dumb. So, you know, so most of the places in America that you know, where you might build new stuff are declining, and they need that, you know, development and you know, real estate investment that will help them. But you get some of these trendy, you know, sort of like hipster places, and people are worried about gentrification in like a few places, and those few places are the ones with all the writers, right? Like Brooklyn. Oh no, don't build a building in Brooklyn. So, you know, often the people complaining about these are first wave gentrifiers who are worried about second wave gentrifiers. You know, so like, you know, hippies who got into real estate, you know, white hippies who got into real estate and moved into like one neighborhood of San Francisco, worry about like, you know, Asian techies, you know, moving in there and, you know, like ruining the neighborhood. Anyway, it's very stupid. Just give people a place to live. Jesus Christ. So building housing in a neighborhood tends to reduce rents in that neighborhood. It tends to reduce rents in other places by even more. So it reduces the surrounding rents by a little bit, but it reduces the, but there's an effect where, you know, like you build a big, you know, gleaming glass tower for yuppies and it'll become a slightly nicer neighborhood. And then that'll put upward pressure on rents, but the increased supply puts downward pressure on rents. Cause then the yuppies who are trying to like rent your little, like, you know, duplex or whatever, like, oh no, I'll go live in the fish tank instead. So the yuppies go to the fish tank. And so then, but then, so the downward pressure on rents does typically overcome the upward pressure on rents. So the gentrification effect is outweighed by the supply effect, even in the neighborhood level. But in addition, that extra supply reduces rents throughout the city because the rich people evacuate whatever other neighborhood they were trying to gentrify and go to the fish tank. Okay, so if you build a giant thing of housing in like the Mission in San Francisco, people who were, you know, in Bernal, you know, techies who are going and trying to like gentrify Bernal will leave and go to that big tower, right? And then so you take so building housing takes gentrification pressure off of like other places. Gentrification is a real thing that happens because of demand shocks, right? So like you know, some tech company moves to like Brooklyn or whatever, and then like a bunch of techies move into Brooklyn, and then all the like lefty writers who live in Brooklyn and, you know, in their polycules and whatnot and converted warehouse spaces are like, oh my God, the techies are moving in. And then the techies move in and they're like, well, I need some place to live, you know, so I can like work at this big fintech company that just moved in. So I'll live in Brooklyn. So then, hey, I'll pay for your warehouse space. I'll pay more. And the landlord who owns the warehouse space, you know, and is, you know, he's like, okay, fine. Well, you can live there. And then you're what used to be a place for like, you know, hippie poly sex cultists becomes gentrified with a bunch of tech workers. And by the time some random blogger moves in there in 2015, you know, expecting to, you know, to some weird place called Pure House, expecting it just to be a whole bunch of like sex cultists, it's all just a bunch of people working on their PowerPoints for tomorrow's presentation. But the murals are still up on the walls.
Yes, exactly.
I don't know where that went, but anyway, don't worry about gentrification. It's a real thing, but building more housing alleviates gentrification.
Yeah, and the reverse problem of gentrification, i.e. a deserted place, is a worse outcome.
Hey, everybody. Eric here with a word from our sponsors.
This one's from listener Nadim Ahmed. It says, Keynesians want governments to spend during bad times and save during good times. So why not institutionalize it? You get a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. During the good times, the government is forced to put some money in an insurance fund, and that insurance fund can only be used during recessions or natural disasters. Otherwise, politicians naturally have an incentive to undertax and overspend. You can even put a limit on how much money that can be put in the insurance fund. What do you think of my proposal? Does any country do anything similar?
Well, so no country does anything similar. Some countries have sovereign wealth funds, which are fine. So you could, a better idea than that idea is to actually just have a Fed for fiscal policy. The Fed, the independent Fed, is actually better at what we call taking away the punch bowl, raising interest rates, than Congress would be, right? So the answer to why don't we do a thing that restrains us from doing the things we want to do is that we don't want to do that. It's like, you know, why don't I, you know, you're fat, why don't you eat fewer calories? Because I like calories, I love potato chips. Like, you know, oh, I would simply eat less potato chips. So anyway, so if you're wondering why nobody does that, that's why, because they don't want to. But also why would, So a fiscal Fed would be a great idea. You have, you know, you give this ability to borrow some money, you know, in bad times, and then the ability to spend money in good times, and then also save up. So saving, having the government save up money in a sovereign wealth fund in good times, then being able to spend that in bad times is actually, like, it's a good idea. We could do it. Would it be enough? Well, no, because, like, you know, sometimes you, what if your fund runs out because you hit a Great Depression and you're like, oops, no more fund. And then you have to just change back to whatever you're doing before. And then also people will just raid the fund during normal times. And then you'll be like, oh, we're raiding the fund. And then you're like, well, don't do that. But I want to eat the potato chips. And so it's like, you know, the Social Security Trust Fund, what happened to that? Anyway, remember Al Gore saying, I'm going to put it in a lockbox. Yeah. This is the Saturday Night Live skit from like 2000. And actually the name of the blog Stratechery comes from this skit and nobody knows that anymore.
Wow. Yeah, so, I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, that's because Al Gore's word that he's always harping on is lockbox, and George Bush's word that he's always harping on is strategery. And so Stratechery is a pun on strategery. Oh. And anyway, so the answer is that, yeah, we could do that and have it basically think more broadly. Think having an independent authority, an independent fiscal authority, you know, would be great. A fiscal Fed would be great. And it would involve Congress giving up some of its power over spending and taxation. And go convince Congress to do this. I think it would be a great idea.
Yeah. That that makes sense. Nadim, thanks for the good question. Here's another question, and it is from David Schechtman. He asks, how and why are politicians so successful in getting large constituencies of Americans to vote against their own economic self-interest?
I don't know. No idea, dude. Hypnosis. Okay. So we do know one technique that they used kind of in the 80s, 70s and 80s, which is basically, you know, progressives, which we then called liberals, wanted to, you know, increase the welfare state, raise welfare spending. And the conservatives mounted a very successful campaign of saying, well, this welfare state is going to go to lazy people. And it was implied lazy black people. And if you looked at survey evidence, people were like, ah, lazy black people, you're going to take all this stuff and you're going to spend it on things that black people spend money on. Like, and at this point, their imagination runs wild. And so, like, so racism. And so if you see Paul Krugman talk about this, he'll just say racism because he's thinking about the 80s. Now, how do they do it now? Not as clear how that works right now, because I think that sort of like stereotypes of like welfare queens and stuff, it's not so much like some people still have those stereotypes, but they're not electorally very important. They're a shrinking set of the electorate and they just all vote for Trump or whatever anyway. But then why did people get grumpy and not like the child tax credit or whatever? Like at first they liked it and then they're like, well, we don't want to make it permanent. Maybe because they thought that there's undeserving people out there. Is that driven by racism or is that driven by just general like unrest and watching a whole bunch of like student protesters do stupid stuff and like imagining that maybe these are like the people who are going to get welfare checks? And I don't know. Probably they're not going to get welfare checks. You had to have a kid to get anyway. So the answer is I have no idea how politicians do this, and I'm not a politician. Like I can try to convince people of stuff with my little bloggy blog, and you know, how well does that work? Maybe a couple people are convinced, but there's some sort of dark magic involved here, and it's probably not just like racism anymore, although at some point it was, but probably not anymore. That's an old, outdated story, and now it's just like maybe Americans are just a bunch of curmudgeonly jerks. There's a whole lot of other kinds of policies that people vote against, like, you know, people are against their economic interests, and I could just, you know, rattle off a few, but like, honestly, you know, people aren't that well educated about what their interests are, to be honest. Like people don't really know what will help them and what will hurt them. Like you saw this, remember during the Tea Party, everyone's, you know, no one remembers this. This was like over 10 years ago, Jesus Christ. There were these signs that said, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah.
You know, protests against like Obamacare is like, keep your government hands off my Medicare. Really? Really? People just don't know. People don't understand what the heck's going on. So ignorance. Anyway.
Yeah. Job Gregory is back with another question.
I love Job Gregory. We need to stop giving Job Gregory so much space, even though I love him, because like there's so many people asking questions. But you know,
the last one, his questions are really good. He says, why did the U.S. choose and continue to back Saudi Arabia in the dilemma of choosing an ally between Saudi Arabia versus Iran? Can you give some historical context about the U.S. or about this relationship, whether it's the overthrow of Iran government in the 50s, Iran Revolution in 79, U.S. hostages in Iran, U.S. backing Iraq in the Iraq-Iran War, 9/11, et cetera?
I mean, you just answered your own question. Like, they took a bunch of hostages and we were mad at them. That's it. Next question.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Job. Okay.
Thanks, Job. You got it. That's it. We are mad.
This question is from Luke Walton, and it's a segue to one of your pieces. He says, I want to ask about the Bank of Japan, the decline in the yen's value and how it affects other economies. I read things like the yen carry trade and was curious about the relationship between rates and various central banks, as well as how the U.S. Fed might take actions by the BOJ into consideration.
That's a great question. I mean, Japan is kind of small and our economy isn't that affected by what happens to Japan. If Japan collapsed, that would be a big deal. But, you know, that we've got a long way to go before they're in danger of that. Basically, so the Fed doesn't take Japan into account at all. And it never will, probably. And Japan has to, you know, take American monetary policy into account a little more, because when American interest rates go up and Japanese interest rates don't go up, then money wants to flow out of Japan into America because, oh, I get a higher interest rate on my bond. I will move my money from the lower interest rate to the higher interest rate. This is the genius of our bond investors. And they are like, oh, low, high, I pick high. And so then, you know, like, is this a trick question? Then they move their money out. You can tell I've been watching a lot of, like, you know, sort of snarky book reviews and movie reviews on YouTube, because I'm speaking in jump cuts at this point. Because that's how they signify flabbergastedness in all those pieces. What am I saying? Japan. So right now, interest rates are low in Japan. You could stop the outflow of money by raising interest rates, but there's a number of problems with that. It would hurt the economy, and it would also make the government have to pay a lot more interest on debt, which would make it raise taxes, which hurt the economy, which ironically would probably make more money move out of Japan. So you'd have to really, really tighten your belt a hell of a lot and accept a big decrease in living standards to stop the outflow. And at that point, you've basically accepted the currency crisis that you're trying to prevent, and sort of impoverishment. So instead, Japan will defend the yen by selling down some of its foreign exchange reserves, of which it has 1.2 trillion. And that's a decent amount. Eventually, you know, if this keeps going on for a long time, it'll run out of that. And then it's in big, deep shit. So, but then, we're not there yet, but it's worth thinking about, you know, today. And so Japan is probably thinking about, you know, creating capital controls to stop outflowing money, because it turns out that those controls are only effective if you have like years of experience. And so you might want to get the years of experience before the crisis. So then I think maybe Japan's thinking about doing this, but I haven't seen anyone talk about it. But if I were them, I'd be thinking about it. But in the meantime, you can just sell dollars to prop up the yen, and that's probably what they're going to do.
Yeah. Relatedly, I want to go to your piece. So you talk about, you know, is Japan having a currency crisis? But maybe we can give a broader background of weak exchange rate, strong exchange rate. You say, hey, weak exchange rate isn't always a bad thing. Why don't you specify when it is a bad thing and when it's not a bad thing?
Well, so a weak exchange rate, we say weak, but actually it's a cheap exchange rate. And so a cheap currency allows you to sell exports very well, because suddenly you're, you know, like Sony TVs go from, you know, costing like, you know, $500 to costing $300. Well, that's a big incentive to buy a Sony TV instead of, you know, whatever, a Hisense TV or whatever, Samsung. So that juices your exports. But of course, Sony has to buy stuff. They've got to buy energy to run their factories. And a lot of that comes from overseas, right? In the form of, you know, oil, coal, natural gas, all that stuff. And they've got to buy, you know, imported components, computer chips or whatnot, or I don't know, glass, tungsten. I just like tungsten. You know, I want to have I like tungsten cubes. I need more of those in my life. Anyway, so then they have to buy those things. So that makes it. So at some point, if you can't buy the inputs to actually make stuff, then being able to sell exports cheaply doesn't help you as much. So there's some point at which, you know, it's weak currency is bad. Also, immigration, if Japan needs to get like foreign labor and you're paying them in yen and the yen's worth nothing, well, then you can't get foreign labor. But you can increase tourism. It's like everyone's going to Japan now. Oh, let's go see the cherry blossoms, says everyone in the world, because the yen's super cheap. And then, of course, in Japan, like the cherry blossoms are just choked with a whole bunch of annoying tourists. And it's like people are like, when does this end? And so anyway, so that's downsides and upsides of a weak currency. The downside is that you can't afford imports. The upside is that you can sell exports more cheaply. America probably has a currency that's too strong, which is why Trump's people are talking about weakening the currency, which is an incredibly risky move because it would destabilize a whole bunch of financial stuff in the world, but is probably in the long run what we need to do. Not necessarily the way they're contemplating doing it, but it's something that we need to do. Anyway, so that's the trade-off. So you want your currency to be like a bit weak, but not too weak. A bit cheap, but not too cheap. Cheap enough for you to sell some exports, but not so cheap that you can't afford imports, right. I guess.
So given that Japan's the yen is getting weaker, what are the options at their disposal? What are the real options versus not the real options?
Well, the first thing you do is you sell your stock of dollars to defend the yen, right? And that you only have a certain number of dollars, so someday that runs out. Like China in 2015 did this, and they sold down over $1 trillion, over $1 trillion of their foreign exchange reserves. They sold down an amount about equivalent to what Japan actually has in total now. To defend the yuan in 2015 when they had a stock market crash and some capital flight. That's actually the largest episode of capital flight in history in terms of the actual amount. So there's your Canadian real estate. But China also had capital controls implemented beforehand, and they strengthened them a lot and stopped people doing like over invoicing from Hong Kong as a way to, get capital out of the country, money out of the country. And so China was trying to save Canada's housing prices too. they were trying very hard and they succeeded in the end, but still there was a lot of capital flight and China had to sell a lot of reserves to defend it. And so Japan can do that, but at some point your ability to do that becomes limited naturally. After that, all you can do is like raise interest rates, implement capital controls. After you sell your foreign exchange reserves, those are the only things you can do. That's it. Done.
Right. And raising interest rates is just too risky for the economy.
Well, it'll hurt the economy. So, but that may be what they do. So Japan may simply bite the bullet and raise interest rates, and then tighten their belt, cut spending on old people. But that means, old people are poorer. But so they might do like austerity combined with interest rate hikes. And this will accelerate Japan's sort of decline from the ranks of the rich countries, which unfortunately is happening now. So hopefully they won't get to that point. Capital controls are sort of the alternative method of doing this. Ultimately, Japan's fundamental economic weakness of being in this sort of structural stagnation, secular stagnation, deflation, is the problem. Because the problem is you can't raise interest rates without hurting the economy. You can't raise taxes without hurting the economy. America has much more room to raise interest rates and raise taxes. We just raised interest rates a whole ton, didn't do shit to the economy. Japan isn't in that position for some reason, probably having to do with things like low productivity, low population growth, and things like that. For some reason, when Japan raises interest rates, it hurts the economy more. Japan, essentially needs faster productivity growth and it needs faster population growth. And it needs those fundamental things before, to give it macroeconomic space. Otherwise, it's going to become a poor country.
Yeah.
So that's Japan is in this bind caused by its real economic situation. 30 years from now, China's going to be in this bind, but they're not yet.
Yeah. When was the last currency crisis, like notable one?
Sri Lanka. Well, Ghana, Pakistan, sort of. We had a bunch coming out of the pandemic. We had a bunch of emerging market ones. When was the last time Britain under Liz Truss? And it had like a very mini currency crisis. And so then she's like, I'm going to cut taxes because that increases growth. Well, instantly like the pound just dropped like a stone. I'm like, oh, that doesn't work. Oops. And then she was out. And then now she's still saying stupid stuff from the margins of British society because Britain is just, I often joke that that wokeness is just a bunch of like white people telling each other, you're white. And then Britain is a bunch of like stupid politicians telling each other you're stupid.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Liz, circular firing squad of ineptitude of the political class of Britain.
There's no coincidence she has an L in her, or her name starts with an L. is exactly. We'll close on that. I have
Amazing.
to run to the airport to make Jacob Hellberg's conference.
Oh
I'm sure
yeah,
it's gonna be a lot
I
of
went last year. It's pretty good. It's pretty fun.
good time with the TikTok stuff. Do you have any
Yes.
quick words on what you would like to see happen with TikTok, or what you think is realistic to happen?
We need a big push to get people to start switching from TikTok to the other things before they, in advance of the deadline. Start putting pressure on them to sell by causing a stampede of users away. Say, because TikTok, the ByteDance, the company is saying, oh, we're not gonna sell, we're just gonna shut it down. We need to then say, publicize to the creators, okay, guys, they're gonna shut it down, better switch. And they'll be so afraid of that, they'll say, okay, well, actually, we might sell. Tell all those people I say hi, tell Hallberg I say hi. And of course to the people at the Chinese Communist Party who monitor every Zoom call, because we used Zoom today. Hi.
It's funny. I've been watching Three Body Problem. Have you seen it? And it's like the aliens are always watching them or something. And I feel like, yeah, the similar comparison. we're being watched. We said nice things within reason. And Noah, always a great
Yeah.
episode.
I'm like, hi, spies. Want to learn about interest rates? Want to learn about macroeconomics? Want to learn about currency movements? Are you bored yet? Anyway.
Yes, exactly. Thank you for everyone who sent questions. Keep sending in great questions. And as always, we'll be back next week. Take
Peace.
care.
Econ 102 is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Moment of Zen, In the Arena, The Cognitive Revolution, and more. If you like what you hear, subscribe and leave us a review in the App Store. You can keep up with both of our Substacks for written analysis of the topics we cover in the show at noahopinion.substack.com and erictornberg.substack.com. Thanks for listening.